Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you may be, across Canada, around the world. My name is Stuart Thompson, and welcome to Personal Transformation. Today is a very special day for me because today I'm going to be talking about the three ladies that are going to be here today. And what I mean by that is I'm talking about empowering women. I'm talking about Kirsty, Rosalia, and I'm talking about Maria. Yes, we're going to be talking a little bit about the Brave Movement and Survivor Council of Canada, but I want to also focus on what these three ladies are doing in the community and abroad. So today, I know I got Kirsty here and I got Maria here, so both of you is welcome. Oh, and Rosalia is here too.
Hey, Stuart.
Hey there. So you heard from my intro. Well, yes, we're talking about our initiative, which is grand and in so many ways that people have no idea what's going on about this yet, which they are going to know. But I want to focus more on you three ladies here today. I want to talk about empowering women and what you're doing, what you've done and what you're doing in the community already today and moving forward. So if you wouldn't mind starting, I guess I'm going to go right from Kirsty, my bottom right on the screen. If you can give a brief introduction of yourself, I would greatly appreciate that. And then I'm going to go to Rosalie and then I'm going to go to Maria.
Well, quickly, you'll get your details. My name is Kirsty White, and let's see, other than Survivors Council, what do I have on the go? I am Indigenous Coordinator for a men's equity organization and family called Voice of Men 360. So that keeps me busy. I have a son who runs an organization called Hoops for Hope, who I co-manage with him. So we do a lot of Indigenous networking. We owe tons of stuff because it's all about equity, inclusion, all of that, and just making space for everybody. And then the other thing I do is I'm a children's author who wrote an Indigenous children's book series based around mainly boys and literacy and empowering young girls from Indigenous communities to show them that there are things that we may not have seen ourselves doing before, but we can do. And it's just been an incredible journey. So yeah, just very busy and lots of things on the go, and then Survivors Council and anywhere else I can help.
Thank you, Kirsty. So happy to have you here today. Rosalia, nice to see you again today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and it's great to be here with all of you. So I'm Rosalia Rivera, and I am a consent educator, a child sexual abuse prevention specialist, and also the chair of the SAGE organization, which leads the Brave Movement, which is working to end child sexual abuse globally. And also a founding member of the Survivors Council of Canada, which I'm so proud to be with all of you, starting this new initiative. And I work predominantly with parents who are survivors. I'm a survivor myself, and I work with parents who, have that experience of being a survivor and then having children and realizing, oh my God, I have to, I want to make sure I prevent this from happening to my kids and breaking the cycle, and how do I do it without being so triggered, because it can be such a intense experience. So I help them navigate that and educate them and really empower them. Let me rephrase that. I help them reclaim their power, because we all have that power already. It's not my task to empower anyone. It's really to help you find that well within yourself, that power you can tap back into. So that's my journey and what I'm up to, and always, working to help protect children and children's rights and create consent culture by dismantling rape culture. So that's what I'm up to.
Thank you ever so much. And now my esteemed colleague, Maria.
Hey, Stuart. Hey, everybody. Thanks for everyone for being here. My name is Maria. I'm the executive director of the Gatehouse. I've worked at the Gatehouse for more than a decade now. Have been very fortunate to meet thousands of survivors who are empowered and are using their voices to help others reclaim their voice. The Gatehouse is a safe place for survivors to come forward and share their story. I'm a mom of two wonderful teenagers, one of which just became an adult, turned 18, which is so wonderful, a new stage in their life. I am also a volunteer at Humber College in the community development degree. I'm an advisory board member to that program. I'm a big believer in community solutions to these social justice issues that we have in our communities. Aside from that, I also volunteer my time as an advisory board member at another organization, the Canadian Centre for Men and Families. They've built a men's shelter that helps trauma survivors, male survivors, and their families as well. And I occasionally donate my time as well to speaking about these issues and recovery and healing from childhood sexual abuse. I'm a survivor myself.
Thank you all so much, and thank you ever so much for being here today. You know, like I said in the beginning, we are going to talk a little bit about the Brave Movement and Survivor Council of Canada, but I think this is, needs to be talked about to a degree as well. And one thing, obviously, you are all women, and you're all coming from different backgrounds. And what I want to talk about, you know, I mean, you guys, ladies, have done some amazing, amazing things over the years. But people don't understand is the struggles you've had to get there. You know, not just obviously being, well, for example, starting a Kirstie, not only are you First Nation, but you're a woman as well. And I can go over to Rosalia and Maria as well. Not only you are a different culture, but you're also women as well. And you've had your struggles to be where you are today. And this is kind of what I want to talk a little bit about. I mean, I think, this calls for celebration as far as I'm concerned, because women don't get recognized enough for what they do, not just for their own personal achievements, but what you guys have done in the community and abroad, helping others at the same time with your experiences. So I want people to know and understand it just hasn't been, pardon the way I put this, a cakewalk, if I can put it in that term, or it hasn't been an easy role. And maybe whoever would like to start, talk about your struggles to be kind of where you are now. I mean, go ahead, Kirstie.
Well, I won't go through all A to Z, but I'm sure somebody else here can also attest to there's a whole other degree when you're doing boys and men's work of being a woman in that and that adds an added degree of difficulty also. I got into, I started out doing youth boys work many, many years ago. I'm very community connected, very youth connected, all those sort of things. But one thing I noticed, especially for men's organizations across Canada, is there was still a lacking space for men of culture. And really, really having a space that understands that they're coming from a different cultural aspect. You may hear stories that you would go, oh my gosh, that only happens in movies, whereas unfortunately that's real life, right? And so a lot of our men and boys are still struggling because the services that are there, which are wonderful, they're just not there in the way of helping Indigenous men and boys. I try and talk lightly because, again, it's one of those things because it's a system fail and there mm-hmm. is a lot of smoke screening that goes with it. Mm-hmm. And I have a tendency to want to just be a truthful, honest person, and I don't. And a cultural aspect, that's another thing. I don't know if Rosalie, the cultural aspect difference, like for us, especially me being Haudenosaunee, under our great law, anything you say, so long as you say it in truth and respect, is okay. And I've learned that, unfortunately, trying to do my kind of business in Western society, that's been a huge cultural difference that kind of thrown me for a loop. Because even with the books originally dealing with big publishers and that kind of thing, of course, everybody's after Indigenous content right now, but they also have their own ideas of what that should be. And it's become, I think, almost twice as stressful now, especially being an Indigenous female in an industry that is technically always been a boys' club. And I don't want to say that because there's many, many great men in that industry too, but it is very male predominant. If you think now, like even a lot of the authors you're seeing books out, it's still very male predominant. Yeah, we have many, many, many different issues with that, Stuart, like being an Indigenous female causes like boxes that I have to jump into and restraints there. And then people, I always have to have validation. It's like a witness, mm-hmm. right? If I have somebody else to say that I'm valid or I have validity, that's when people seem to pay attention outside of like my own community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really, really hard to grasp, I think, culturally, is the fact that we really try to uplift each other. And but that, I mean, that's also caused trauma now too, because now you have our communities competing because we have these boxes we have to go in. And to give you an example, like I never get to be like Chris Dewight, the children's author. I have to be Chris Dewight, the Indigenous children's author. Like it has to be clear that I'm an Indigenous children's author, and I don't understand why like that's such a thing. Same with I advocate like award shows like the Junos and stuff like that. Like this year at the halftime show or the entertainment party you've seen, it was all Indigenous performers, which was wonderful to see. But I don't think what people realize is they still only get to win in Indigenous categories. So someone like my cousin, Derek Miller, who's a Juno Blues Award-winning artist, he is still only ever going to be a Indigenous Blues winner. He didn't get to go into the, you know, the regular Blues category for the Junos. He had to, you know, kind of get in his own box. And I think that's where we see a lot of struggles, especially with Indigenous females in any type of business. Now we're seeing it, right? It's just, it's really, really hard. Everybody thinks that we're uneducated or unknowing, or we just want to make a fuss, or, you know, we're still back to, in a lot of ways, that whole savage mentality, right? That if an Indigenous person thought they're only speaking up to create some sort of havoc or degree, where I just really, really working hard at trying to create discussions, right? And it's a matter of how you look at my content and how you take my content. But the main thing is I really, really just try and focus on, you know, the learning aspect and sharing and education. And even that seems really hard to do, but mm-hmm. I keep at it every day. And again, I think knowledge is power. And I think as women in our spaces and doing what we do, I think you have to have a passion, especially as a woman in some of our industries. Like it's just, you really, really got to have a passion. Unfortunately, and I don't want to talk for everybody for all of the time, but I think as women, they also come across as like when we're talking about safety around our children, when we're talking about education around our children, when we're talking about those things, it's almost like, oh, here we go. Here's a mama. You must upset her. And it's kind of really getting grotesque that they can't stop and look at the fact that we are just trying to start conversations and really, really educate around what's really going on, especially with children. I mean, and every other different parts of the system, right? Me, I mainly focus children because of my children's books and things like that. But that also comes from an Indigenous survivor stance. And that is because as our residential survivors, when I went and spoke to them, the one thing they really want to get out there is the inner child work, because there's no place around us anymore that is geared for children. And I'm sure Rosalie could take over from here, but one thing our survivors are saying is that we don't look at is one of the reasons we don't see that our children aren't safe is because everything around us is adults. When their kids were little, even though they were trained maybe to not speak about it or those kinds of things, they were still more aware of it because adult kind of behavior doesn't belong in child settings. And it speaks volumes when you see it in those settings. And so with our survivors, that's what we're looking at is the fact that, you know, when we go to places now, we almost want our children to act like little adults. And then, you know, we tell them to, they're too old for certain things or this, that, and that kind of thing. But if at 12, 13, they're too old for coloring, bubbles, playing, skipping, then what are they old enough for? And on that note, I'll hand it over to Rosalie.
Thank you, Kirstie.
Thanks. Sorry, there's some issue with my internet, but I'm back. I resonated with so many things that Christy was talking about, especially, you know, as it relates to women, particularly mothers, talking about or trying to educate community members about the statistics around child sexual abuse and anything that's related to prevention. You know, there's a tendency to think, oh, you know, that person's being paranoid or they're overprotective or, you know, something must have happened. I think there's, you know, there's that stigma. And unfortunately, that is still prevalent, but I'm always of the mindset that we have to keep doing the work, and I think change makers are always going to be looked at as causing a fuss because we are actively working to make change, and change is not always welcome, but it is necessary, and so we recognize that that's the work that needs to be done, and we keep doing it. And I think that when I started doing this work and realized that there were sort of these hurdles, particularly as moms, you know, trying to get the word out and trying to educate others, that you were going to come up against this kind of attitude in culture, because we do live in a rape culture. And really that is saturated with, you know, victim blaming. It's saturated with, you know, this idea that women are hysterical and exaggerating. And, you know, so you have all of those stereotypes that people try to perpetuate. But when we take a stand and when we recognize that when we can come together as a community, we are stronger in numbers. We are not alone in our perspective and, you know, in sharing this information. When more of us do it collectively, it really can start to change the narrative. So I remain hopeful, even though it can be exhausting at times to push against, you know, the mainstream narrative. But I think that the more of us collectively raise our voices and speak up and normalize these conversations, right? We destigmatize the topic by normalizing those conversations. So I'm always trying to rally everyone who comes in contact with my work and content. And I think much like Christy was saying, you know, we just have to keep showing up and doing the work. I mean, producing children's books to help, you know, educate children, also educates the adults in the children's lives because they're reading the book to those kids, right? So I think that just by being creative with how we do it and coming from a good place, like having that true intention, even if not everyone recognizes it right away, we are attracting the right people to us to connect, right? The work that I did ultimately attracted me to connect with Maria and Christy and Stuart and Arthur, and we came together now to do something that is lacking. And so I think that although being a woman and, you know, being part of that, what is considered stigmatized content, you know, just continuing to do the work and showing up and finding the community, attracting the community, nurturing that community, I think is the most powerful way that women in general can continue, you know, to grow and thrive and do this work. And I also believe that it isn't just women's work, right? And I think, you know, Stuart, you're here as, you know, testimony to this, that we need the partnership, you know, of men and all genders to really support this work because it impacts everybody. It isn't just women or men. I have three young boys. I want to make sure that they are both protected and also don't become abusers, right? And so that's part of the work that we're doing here as well. And so I'm grateful, you know, for people like you, Stuart, who recognize that this that women need support. We need to support men. We all need to support each other. And that's how we can, you know, help women be able to live in the society in an equitable way because we are all supporting each other. It's not about male bashing. It's not about, you know, just letting women do the work on their own. It's about everybody coming together. So, yeah.
Can I actually, just for one quick second,
yeah.
Roughly, that brings up a good point, especially because I do a lot of men and boys work. I really, really, really want people to understand because one thing, the minute I say that I'm part of a men's organization, like right away, is like I'm a defender of men's bad behavior. And that is not at all, especially, like, I can't speak for everybody, but I do know a lot of men's organizations that definitely aren't like that, and especially mine. As I sit on the board and I'm a very, very active part of our organization, I really, really want to remind them this has nothing to do with blaming people, and this has nothing to do with that putting shame, especially Indigenous men. We really, really work hard at reminding them that this is more around education than it is shaming them, or especially because some of them coming out of situations they've come out of, I can understand why they would be confused on why all of a sudden now they're monsters. We have young boys that are coming into certain residential spaces for certain issues. The same thing we have to explain to them. They've seen it for generations, and now they're sitting there going, why am I in trouble? Why am I being, you know? And we're really trying to push the fact that we aren't attacking them, and we really are doing work to help support and uplift them. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think it's a very, very important piece, especially for men who are hurting, to hear we're not here to blame, we're not here to any of those things, right? It's just, there's got to be education, there's got to be safety, those are important things, and it really doesn't have to do with blame and shame and all of those things.
Thank you. Maria, and very good point, by the way, Kirsty and Rosalia.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you, everyone. Yeah, I want to jump off of that last point. At the Gatehouse was the first time I ever worked with men in a helping role. And I had the same thoughts, like, how was I going to help a man and understand what it meant to be a man, and some of the challenges that men face because of sexism, because of patriarchy, because of colonialism, all these oppressive systems and rules that have been imposed upon us. As women as well. But hearing men's stories for the first time was quite healing for me as well, to empathize with the struggles that men face. One of the main ones was not being able to share their feelings, and having repressed feelings for decades, of course, would lead to anger or violence or any of those other things that men have been taught. That's how you show what a maleness is, what masculinity is. To really, you know, empathize and celebrate male survivors who come forward and share their stories and cry in our rooms and talk about what happened to them and how they feel and how they want to move forward and how they want to pay restitution, whatever that looks like, to the people that they have hurt as a result of being traumatized as children, because there are broken relationships, there are addictions, there are mental health issues that surface. There are ostracized, even family members or ostracized friendships that have happened because of the trauma. So really important to note how those things contribute to how a person is, how I got to be here today. It was, I think, the original question, Stuart. Mm-hmm. Sexism played a role in that and trying to deconstruct that. As a Portuguese woman, we are taught, and I'm talking about like raised in the 80s with a 1950s mentality, we're taught that women belonged in the kitchen and were made for one thing, to bear children, and all these really unhelpful and shameful beliefs. Like we're even having a university degree and going to school, I didn't do that until later on in life, and that's wonderful. But again, having to put the needs of the family and the needs of the children, that was my purpose, to be a mother to my kids. So if I did anything outside of that purpose, great, but it wasn't celebrated, right? Oh, yeah, you went to university. Oh, yeah, you got a degree. Yeah, you have a degree, kind of thing. So it's an interesting dynamic, and it is starting to change as the generations have more access to information, for sure, and have more conversations with people like Rosalia and Kirsty and myself and yourself, Stuart, advocating for children, and that children's voices matter, and the children do have rights. That children are not objects, they are not property, and that's another thing that women were seen as. Even though maybe some of the Portuguese men who are watching this are like, I don't believe my wife is property. well, you may treat her like that. You don't even know it because sexism and patriarchy are a real thing that operates in society today. And as Rosalia was talking about, like, rape culture, the sexualization of children happens all the time. People buy things or certain types of clothing or materials to sexualize young girls and boys. There's just a lot going on in society. I'm so grateful to be working with all of you on this to create the Survivors Council of Canada, to bring survivors' voices to the forefront and empower survivors together to help others who are still out there struggling. The reality is that sexual abuse is happening right now. As we broadcast this, tomorrow, the day after, 2 weeks ago, yesterday, it happens, and it keeps happening every day. A lot of society doesn't want us to believe that. They don't know the prevalence. They don't know the true impact. The media shares it when it's sensational is another, you know, unbelievable thing that happens, but it does. We get attention when there's a big celebrity out there that talks about themselves being assaulted. Well, what about the kid down the street? What about my neighbor? What about, you know, that it's happening right now? What about the Indigenous children? And their
That's
children?
What I was going to say. And those spaces, right? And the worst part is I don't think they see how that's perpetuating, especially for young girls, but they get to see that all of the, well, one main ethnicity seems to be able to have that space as a victim, and all the rest of us are, you know, especially for our young girls, are liars or drug addicts, or they asked for it, or, I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. And I think that's one thing that people don't even look at is how the media perceives these young children's worthiness, right? Even through the Me Too movement, when we look at it, yes, in some ways is it good? Absolutely. But in some ways, for some communities, it was horrific. It wasn't good. Because we had now young girls who had been sexually traumatized not once, twice, three, four, five, six times over, who now seeing all of, you know, the girls at school posting the Me Too and all of that, and there was no way they could have. They still had to get on the school bus and go home to their community. There was no way. So it was a trauma trigger for some ethnic communities, right? And I think that's one thing we don't look at is how media really, really puts self-worth, especially on ethnic women. Any show you see, like, and there's a lot of them that just don't portray us very well at all, don't put us in leadership. And even if we are in leadership roles, they make it look sloppy or, you know. And I'm sure, like, Rosalia, who looks at a lot of content and go, like, we are now, most content that we think is going out for the safety of children is actually content for the safety of adults, and that makes no sense to me. Because as an adult, most of us know how to keep ourselves safe now. And the problem is we're forgetting we still have zero safety. And then when you start, especially survivors, and they start seeing that other people, or they feel, I should say, that, you know, one certain demographic has more of a voice than they do, or why are they always the ones who have to be the liars or dramatic, or, you know, the family wants it quiet, or all of those things, right? And it wasn't until those girls started talking through the Me Too movement, and I'm sure on TikTok, some of you might have seen a lot of the Indigenous MMIWs come out and speak out that the Me Too movement was actually quite traumatizing and triggering to Indigenous girls to see this go on, because there would be one person who would do a Me Too post, and then an Indigenous girl, and she would be slammed all the way through it on, you know, well, what were you wearing? It's just gotten horrific. And those are the sides that I don't think people are really, really seeing, especially when they're Indigenous women. When we grew up with no self-worth, when you see that even society is now deemed it as you have no self-worth, imagine being now a survivor. And a lot of times, a multiplied time over survivor.
Yeah.
And we need to start making more spaces for our ethnic children to feel like they're part of that survivor movement too, because they still really feel like they've been left behind even in that. Because again, a lot of them are still living life with trauma. Even if a lot of this is in the immune system, how long will it take before it trickles down into ethnic systems? right? Because everything, it takes longer to get into ethnic communities. So even on that front, it'll be like they'll still see other survivors, you know, as we're bringing more attention and stuff. And that's one thing I just have really been cautious of, is reminding our girls that I sit here because them too, we're on this train with everybody, and I promise them that they're not going to have to wait. They're going to be survivors just like everybody else. They're going to have that space. They're going to feel that. And that's what they need, because again, we can have survivors still feeling like they're way being left behind, and that their self-worth is dictated through a movement or through media or those kinds of things, because then we still have very silent survivors.
Thank you. So Maria and Rosalie, any other thoughts before I move on to the next question? There's been lots of great talk here, and it's awesome. Thank you.
I'll just say, I mean, I agree with Christy in terms of making education culturally sensitive and recognizing that there are different lived experiences, and how we communicate that education makes a big difference. With immigrant communities, for example, in the U.S., which I was a part of growing up, you always felt alienated from the general sort of sense of community that was created in a school, for example, right? And kids, you know, I went to either predominantly white schools or predominantly black schools growing up in New York. And so I understand that sort of sense of like, is that information for me? Is it relevant for me if it's being shared just with this community? And then just even for like communication with the parents, right? Like, is the education here to be relevant to the parent who's then going to take action on, you know, sharing that with their children, or having a greater understanding of the problem if it's not even in a language that they can understand? I know that, you know, in the U.S., but also here in Canada, you know, we have many immigrant populations that are not getting access to the kind of information that is going to be really crucial for them, particularly if within their culture there are certain norms, you know, that are being challenged by this new education. And if they don't have that bridge, you know, to really connect with that content or material or education, it may not, you know, it just may not land for them and not be implemented. And so those children don't get the education and support that they need. So I just wanted to second what Christy said. It's really very important. You know, when we talk about connecting with all populations, that's something that I think, you know, whether it's governments or organizations or whoever, you know, youth serving organizations, whoever is doing it, that becomes, you know, more in the forefront of how they distribute that kind of information to really help kids.
Awesome. Thank you. Any other thoughts, Maria? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Kirsten.
Sorry. Just off of what Rosalia was saying, again, because all of us come from different ethnic backgrounds, say we were doing an education piece in the classroom and say content was being sent home to the parents. If we're looking at older children who can read, and as a literacy advocate, I will tell you, each one of us would have read that form, and some of us may not have taken it and handed it over to our parents for fear of other things. And that's what we have to look at in the way of safety too, right, is the fact that as survivors coming from different ethnic communities, we should also realize that there's different ethnic things going on in our communities that they used to, I guess, almost hold survivors hostage. Like, I don't want to say that, but it puts them in a state of fear, right? Like, you know, you don't say this in front of so-and-so, or you don't say that in front of so-and-so. And as children in different ethnic backgrounds, that's one thing as we start dealing with the older ones and that kind of thing, is really teaching them safety, because some of them can't go home and discuss these kind of things with their parents or grandparents or the person they're living with. The other thing I wanted to bring to light, which I think the other two ladies could actually help me with, it is the fact of we have a problem teaching safety, especially to parents, because anything that has to do with sexual abuse in our communities automatically has to do with the Children's Aid Society. And unfortunately, due to just what's gone on over the years, Indigenous communities do not feel safe when it comes to that agency and protecting children. We've had multiple issues that has proven that it is not safe for our children. So that's another thing we really have to look at, especially with ethnic kids, is the fact that parents, just for fear of certain systems, could be apprehensive to this. And I think, again, bringing awareness that, you know, we're really just trying to educate on how safety planning is and all those kinds of things, especially in those communities, because, again, the minute anything has to do with child sexual assault in our communities, it's like they've brought in a whole parade, because we have the authorities in umpteen fold descend, right? And so, again, I think some of that is even a parent who may suspect something's going on in the home with another parent may not say anything, just for the simple fact of fear of what that may create within their home when it comes to certain systems. And then again, now we have two victims.
Absolutely right. Maria or Rosalia?
Yeah, I wanted to jump in on what Christy just said. One, the word shame came to mind, Christy. There's a lot of shame and stigma around the topic of sex, sexual abuse, sexuality, masturbation, like these kinds of things were not talked about in my household. Periods for women or girls, never knew what a period was. My mom didn't teach me any of that. Didn't even know that body hair was going to start growing at a certain time. I thought I was dying. I shaved my arm. And it sounds comical, but I'm like, oh my God, I'm dying. There's hair growing on my arm.
Exactly.
Right? So those kinds of culturally influenced things need to be gently talked about and dismantled, because shame underpins a lot of that, right? It's shameful to talk about sex in my culture. I don't even think that even the woke parents at this time have yet broken into gently talking with their kids about boundaries, right? And I'm hoping that Rosalia will show some of her books on screen today as well, because I know you have some books that you recommend to parents to share with their children. As you were talking, Rosalia, earlier about, you know, as the parent is sharing the book, they're also learning, right? And sometimes it's the first time that they're learning about this for themselves, which is sad, but it's true. It happens all the time. And that goes for men, dads, moms, aunts, uncles, really. The other point, Christy, that you brought up was educating children on childhood sexual abuse. We have a facilitator, a volunteer, Charmaine Lovern, who's trying to get Lovern's Law into Ontario schools. And it's been a struggle of 7 years to try and get this bill to pass and become a law. And there's a petition still going on to the state to try and get this into our schools. Again, I think shame and fear are at the root of why it hasn't been pushed enough by the government systems that we have in place. And also, the fact is that 90 to 95% of child abuse cases, the child knows who the offender is. And it's usually someone in their family or extended family or close to that family, because offenders will use all kinds of manipulation tactics to also gain access to the child if they're not in the family. It's rarely stranger danger. What were you taught in school? I grew up mostly in Canada. Stranger danger. Don't talk to strangers. Sure, there was an incident in my childhood where I was walking home and there was a stranger who tried to lure me to his car, and that was one. But the rest are people known. The other offenders in my life are people that are known to me and my family. So it's interesting that our society still perpetuates that myth of stranger danger when it's like, no, the kid knows who it is. There is one, I do have one repressed memory where I cannot identify one of the offenders. My mind has just blocked it out, and that happens for survivors. We have this lovely structure in our brain called the hippocampus, and it's responsible for filing memory. And in traumatic events, that hippocampus stops filing memories for some folks. And it's a protective measure. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not damaged. You're not broken. Your brain protected you in the way that you need it. That's why some survivors also seem to float out of their bodies and experience a dissociative state when the abuse is happening. So on that note, just know that it's 90 to 95% of the time the kid, the child knows who the offender is. So enough of this stranger danger business. It's good incorporated anyway in safety, yes. I'm not saying take it out, but I'm also saying that it's about time that we start talking about what is happening in family dynamics and the neighbors that know the kids or the people that are so nice and go to church all the time or the priest that is so wonderful that also abuses children on the side.
Thank you. You know, so I'm just looking at the time here. Obviously, I kind of figured this was going to happen, but that's all right. We're moving along here, and I'm going to kind of move it up a little bit here now, and I really thank you for what you said. And this is a great example, folks, for that are listening and watching. This is empowering women that are doing their stuff, and they're not just talking about it, they're actually doing it. So, which kind of brings me to this, which we're doing as a whole, all of us, and all of the person we're missing here today is Art, but we'll catch up with him later. Let's talk a little bit about the Brave Movement and Survivor Council of Canada. And I think I'll start off with Rosalie on this because she has been, first off, she's been kind of the lead with this right from the beginning and then brought us on board. So maybe, Rosalie, can you talk a little bit about the Brave Movement and what has transpired over the last 6-7 months that brings us here today? Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for asking. It's one of the most exciting things I think that I have been a part of in my entire life, which is this new initiative of global survivors that have come together to do a survivor-centered movement to end child sexual abuse. And one of the things that I think distinguishes us is, first of all, that we are all survivors. We've all experienced this abuse. For myself in particular, just for, to kind of touch on Chrissy's point, is my father was my abuser. And, how do you, first of all, report that if it's your own parents, right? You, especially if no one is talking to you about it. My mother is a survivor, but she was abused by a teacher when she was 14. And so for her, it was about the dangers outside of the home, right? And because she wasn't educated, but she didn't know to look for the signs in our home. And I was the only thing that I was given in terms of instruction was like, don't let anyone touch you there. And so when it happened, I felt like I was at fault because I didn't stop what happened when I was told not to let it happen. And so this is why education is so critical. And for me, obviously, coming from a prevention perspective, that's one of the pillars of the Brave Movement, is really focusing on prevention. But the three pillars, in total, which are very similar to the Survivors Council of Canada, are prevention, healing, and justice. And the beautiful thing about the movement is that all of the survivors, there's 15 of us that have founded this movement, we all are activating and doing advocacy in those different three pillars in different ways. One of our most recent goals that Stuart, of course, you were part of the G7 task force, was to get our cause, our mission on the agenda so that the leaders, the G7 leaders would see the importance of funding, the issue of putting money behind the words of a commitment to help us end child sexual abuse. And I think it's an important distinction also to say we're not fighting child sexual abuse, we are ending it. And our goal is to do something that is bold and transformative in a way that the world has never seen before. We are only 3 months old, really. Our website just launched in April. And, we've already done so much that behind the scenes, and we're starting to become more and more visible. We want to make sure that this topic becomes a topic that is no longer taboo, that is not stigmatized, that we can talk about it. Our silence as a world culture is exactly what perpetuates the problem. When we don't talk about it, we give the power to offenders to continue abusing children with impunity. And that is what we are working to end. We want to, normalize the conversation so that everyone can talk about it, so that we can start to put prevention measures in place in really powerful ways, like Lever's Law. Like, these are the kinds of things that we need everyone to be talking about and to start educating others about and to, create that consent culture. This is what will prevent the next wave of Me Too from happening. So, you know, it's very exciting that these members of this group of the Brave are just, I'm so honored to be working alongside them to do this incredible, powerful work, and that it's helped me to connect with other people like yourselves to then, like, let's say, okay, how can we now do this in a local way within our countries while we stay connected, right? Because, again, this is about community and about staying connected and about sharing resources. This isn't about competing for who gets, you know, to be on the world stage. This is about let's all, you know, raise each other up. You know, there's that saying, of course, like a rising tide lifts all boats. And this is what the Brave Movement intends, is to be that rising tide that can help all of the organizations who are already doing this work in silos to come together, join forces, and really attack this problem, like, you know, in a way that the world has never seen before, because it is out of control. The pandemic has exacerbated the issue like we've never seen before. It's at, you know, the highest levels in history. I was just I was listening to a summit that happened in Brussels a few weeks ago from the We Protect Global Alliance held the summit, and they focused on online abuse. And one of the statistics that was jaw-dropping to me was that since 2010, so 12 years now, that they started really tracking online exploitation and child sexual abuse material online and online safety, the rates of abuse and reporting have gone up by 6,000%. And again, this is just strictly online. We're not even talking about offline abuse, which, you know, compounds itself, right? It's online abuse and offline abuse end up making each worse. And so just to look at that number and how that's exploded because of the internet, because of so many factors, and predominantly because we're not talking about it, you know, just was something that additionally fueled me to say, you know, this is the time to act, and we need every hand on board to do this. So that's what the Brave Movement is about. And through it, I've connected with you and everyone here to start the Survivors Council of Canada so that we can take action locally and hopefully, you know, through that model also help other countries do the same.
Thank you. And which kind of brings you right to that. We have started a Survivor Council, and maybe talk a little bit about our purpose of, or rather our mission statement and a little bit more, if you wouldn't mind, please, Rosalia.
Yeah, I don't want to take up all the space. I was going to ask if Maria wanted to talk about that. I can just say, you know, they're very similar. I think that our distinction with one of the pillars is that we are talking about transformative justice because of what we see as a need here in Canada specifically, and how it needs to be changed. We need to look at it critically. And with the Survivors Council, one of our goals is, you know, to make sure that we are an advisory board for the government, because we want to make, you know, substantial change as it relates to the laws with, you know, with children being victimized and how perpetrators are dealt with, and how can we make it more than just a punitive system, where really healing isn't actually happening, you know, and because ultimately, child sexual abuse is something that doesn't just happen in that moment. It's something that gets carried through life. And if we're not helping children, you know, in the moments that they need it, and we're not finding ways to prevent future abuse from recurring, you know, in different ways that we haven't seen to this date, you know, till now, it's like you put someone in jail, and did that really do anything? Is that person going to leave, you know, get out and then reoffend? Did they learn anything? Have they, you know, gone to therapy to get the support that they need so that they're not offending again? Is the child getting the right support? You know, did they go through child protective services and that re-traumatize them? Like, what are the systems that, you know, we need to look at to make sure that it is transformative and not just punitive? So that's one of the elements that I'm really excited about, because I see so many times children report and then they go through this really re-traumatizing cycle. The offender, you know, doesn't really get the quote-unquote justice in terms of, like, did that fit the crime that happened, and is that person getting the support that they need to make sure that they see what happened, like these long-term consequences, and is that person getting the mental health resources that they need to make a change? Maybe it was, you know, something that happened generationally for them. You know, I think we discount how generational trauma impacts people, and, you know, how that can be a what's fueling part of that issue within an entire family and generations within that family, right? So I think that's one of the things that's really exciting for me, is to see that we are going to work within, you know, with a larger network within Canada. We're actively looking for more members to join, because we feel that more minds and resources pulling together to create, you know, better ideas, transformative ideas, is what's going to help us lead the way forward, to be able to then advise the government in really powerful ways to make change.
Yeah, we're not just a bunch. Yeah, and we're not just a bunch of screaming victims wanting justice. We want action, and, you know, and pardon the way I put this, but there's been so much talk, or let me rephrase that, or bullshit talk, if I can put it in that phrase, and it's gone on for years and years and years, which brings us to this. And now I'm going to pass it over to Maria, because we only have a little bit of time left. If Maria can, if I can ask for you to comment as well. And also, same thing with Kirstie, and then I hate to say, but we're done in time. Time's just gone by.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Rosalia, jumping off of your point on transformative justice. Looking at the causal or correlational factors that contribute to these happening, there's not one set of factors out there. There's not one study out there that says, if you experience this and this and this, become an abuser. Those things, like poverty is one, but affluent families are also, you know, facing childhood sexual abuse. It doesn't happen only in impoverished communities. You need to let go of that myth as well. And looking at, yes, poverty may be a contributing factor. Addiction may be a contributing factor. Mental health issues might be a contributing factor. Lack of employment may be a contributing factor. So we need to work as a society to address some of these issues to continue on that prevention. Right? Education is another prevention factor. We need to educate our children, our families, our communities globally, but we're starting here in Canada. And then working with other organizations like the Brave Movement and others across the pond, as Stuart puts it, across the Atlantic Ocean, to bring awareness, to bring knowledge and expertise together. As Rosalia said, we can't do this alone. We have to stop working in these silos. We have to stop competing for the same funds. There needs to be more funding directed at prevention and also treatment of both offenders and survivors. Access to treatment is wishy-washy at best. There are some places that are funded. Clinical definitely receives government funding. Peer support is one of those places, like the Gatehouse, doesn't have for government funding. We have to apply for grants to get funding. It shouldn't be like that. It should be an automatic, yes, you're doing this good work, you're helping survivors, your programs work, here's the money, right? Why do we have to compete for such a small bucket? So there needs to be more money infused by our government system, because they have access, they have control over them, to these programs, to these communities. There shouldn't be Indigenous communities without water. Like, we talked about this last week, that shouldn't happen. Poverty at horrific levels in Indigenous communities should not be happening in this country, yet it is, and it is potentially a contributing factor to child sexual abuse. To look at all of those and try and address those issues, and it seems overwhelming, because when we're talking about poverty, is a big, big issue. Addiction is another one, right? Mental health is another one. Often, even these systems work separated from one another, right? So the food bank that is helping someone access to food can also be a resource to say, hey, if you have experienced childhood trauma, here's this resource called the Gatehouse. Give out our pamphlets. It should be an automatic. People who are walking in, or CAS is investigating a case of childhood sexual abuse within that family. If there's historical abuse and if parents don't disclose, here's a resource called the Gatehouse. They're for you, right? And if it's an Indigenous parent, Indigenous or Child and Family Services, there is a Native Child and Family Services here in Toronto. They feel like they operate separate as well. And they each have their own Jewish Family Services. It's a separate entity, right? how much they collaborate with one another. That I'm still not knowing in that, so I want to know more about that. And Christy's going, I want to say something. I'm going to go to Christy.
That actually goes back to my first moment of the box. Unfortunately, every Indigenous business is. To give an example, I was speaking to somebody last week or 2 weeks ago, and they said, how does the statement sound that the last thing an Indigenous person needs is another nonprofit? Everything is funded, government funded for Indigenous people, everything. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize there was a trust fund. And it's a simple Google search, and it's called the Indian Trust Fund, and it was left by the king to take care of the Indigenous people here in Canada. And that was Canada's responsibility to use that money for. And nowhere are we seeing it down into our communities. And again, how can you provide safety when you can't provide water or housing or a safe space? Like you have families stacked on top of families because they're living in a shack. And, you know, when I go home and I look at the level of safety on reserves, that's the kind of thing where Western society's got to get their safety measures. You are in ground zero. When people have been pushed to the point of no water, I mean, there's some reserves where their children right now, as we're sitting here speaking, are breaking out in rashes from head to toe from mercury poisoning, from the water. Imagine what those parents' mental states are right now. And they're in a community where if any of those babies start crashing, they have to fly them out to the hospital. How do we provide safety for children in those kind of situations? And then are we really, really just again smoke screening everything that we're providing safety, or are we really going to start taking action? Because we can help a lot of, you know, up here people in a certain system. But when a system is completely government funded and they will do everything possible to not be able to easily access any of those resources. And I'm sure of little things, you know, when you have houses that should be condemned and you have 7, 8 family members, multiple generations living in a home, how are we talking about safety of children? You add the poverty, as we said, the addictions, the just, and I mean, there's some reserves where it's just desolate. There's nothing. And then, you know, I'd like to see a world where we could provide safety for all children, but especially children in our own communities, because we can't even provide water or housing for them. And that's the truth when it comes to why Survivor Council, all the work we do, everything, because there are still kids that you would think the kind of things that are happening to them wouldn't be. But that's not their reality, and that's not their truth. Some of them don't even have a school to report it to a teacher. Some of them don't have a library or a shopkeeper or a neighbor that they can trust to report it to. So again, the government of Canada really, really in this whole truth and reconciliation, we really got to start as survivors at the truth. Because that's a big part of survivors, is it's the truth of the story. It's the truth of the situation. It may not be pretty. It may not be what everyone wants to see, but it's the truth of Canada, and that has to be addressed.
Amen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. All of you have brought up some really, really good points. And you know what? I would say that we're done for today, but we're not done. We are going to be back. We have a lot of things to talk about in the future, such as Survivor Council, which we are organizing right now to put together. And we have some, we'll have some other big announcements that will be coming up over the next, well, I won't say months upon months, but in the next short little while, because we are moving pretty rapidly with this. And actually, I can't wait to talk about some of the things that will be coming up that we've already done and accomplished, and which we're almost there now, which I can't say until it's done. So I'll be very conservative and I'll leave it at this. other than thank you, ladies, for coming here today. And to me, like I say, ladies and gentlemen, this is a great example of empowering women doing their stuff, right? They're doing it. They're not talking about it. They're not sitting in a closet crying at home, which people might perceive or project. But that's not the case. These ladies are doing it. I mean, don't you get it? They're doing it. And to me, that's inspiration, not just as a man, but as a human being. So I hope you all take this to heart as I am right now and recognize what these ladies are doing for your community and for the better, you know, for the better of all of us moving forward. So today I want to thank you with all my heart, ladies, for coming here today. And thanks for listening, folks. And you're not done with listening to us yet. So please hang on when we hang up. So have a great day. Or actually, you want to say one last thing before we go? Anybody? Do you want to say bye? Is that all?
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Well, folks, we'll talk to you again. We're not done, like I say. So thank you. And I just got to end this one. All these buttons here.